Welcome to the Confluence Investment Market Update Conference Call. Your host for today's call is Mr. Wayne Knowles. Go ahead, Mr. Knowles.
Well, thank you, and thank you all for joining us today for this call hosted by Confluence Investment Management. As the operator said, I'm Wayne Knowles, the National Sales Director, and like you, I'm witnessing not only a nation's reaction, but a global reaction to growing concerns of how to arrest the spread of the coronavirus, and maybe importantly for us, deal with the fear that investors are experiencing right now. At a time like this, I really can't think of two people I'd rather hear from on this subject, Keller and Bill O'Grady, and we will do so in just a few seconds. But before we turn this over to Mark and Bill, there are some housekeeping items that I need to mention to us all. First, at the outset, your lines will be muted, but just know there is an opportunity after Mark and Bill give their remarks for you to be able to queue up and, through the operator, ask a question. Importantly, there will be a replay of this call, which we hope to post to our website. So, yes, there is a replay coming. And then one other key point for all of us to keep in mind on the call today, we are going to be unable to address any question on specific holdings in any of our portfolios. But if you do have questions that relate to any of Confluence's strategies, I encourage you to contact one of our sales team or feel free to email us at the same email address that was put in the invitation, info@confluenceim.com. And we'll make sure your questions get answered in a timely fashion. So we do want to hear from you if you have questions, but just on the call, neither Mark nor Bill can address any individual holding. And as you might be aware, any discussion today that we will have is based upon sources and data which are believed to be accurate and reliable. Opinions and forward-looking statements expressed are subject to change without notice. And importantly as well, this information does not constitute a solicitation or offer to buy any security. And before I turn it over to Mark, I will say the Confluence website is packed with great research information, some of which comes out daily, on a weekly basis. We write on the business cycle. And at a time like this, if you're not signed up to receive what we do on a regular basis, I would encourage you to do so. Mark and Bill have been working together now for 30 years. Mark Keller is Confluence's Chief Investment Officer and CEO, and Bill O'Grady is our Chief Market Strategist. At the core of what we do as an investment manager is to try and understand the world we find ourselves in, not the one we wish existed. Our proprietary research informs and guides decision-making for three different investment teams at Confluence: asset allocation, value equities, and international. So at this time, I'd like to turn it over to Mark Keller.
Thank you, Wayne. And just a moment, I'm going to have Bill lead things off and provide the macro background to discussion, and then I'll come back with some comments about our various portfolio strategies and how we are approaching this macro background that Bill will describe. We first want to express our thanks to you for your working with us through the years, both in good times and in difficult times. And clearly, these are difficult times. Hope you all are observing best practices to regarding this virus that is afflicting the world, not just the nation, and in order to prevent infection and prevent the spread of infection for both yourselves and your families, you should know that Confluence is likewise observing best practices. Most of our staff are working from home. We have a small mission critical staff in the office and or at our disaster recovery site. We have split them into teams to rotate as needed. All this is to make sure that we can continue to serve you effectively. Having said that, let's go to Bill O'Grady to provide us with the macro and economic background to events of the day. Bill?
Thank you, Mark. Got a lot to cover, and so let's just dig right in. First off, we are probably in recession. Now, that may sound just a little bit like no duh, but actually there isn't a lot of printed evidence out at this juncture to tell us that. We mentioned that in our recent 2020 Outlook update, but there is plenty of anecdotal evidence to suggest that we are probably going to be in one. We would anticipate that the official marking of the recession will be either March or April. That's why, because we haven't gotten confirmation in the actual economic data, we still put the odds at 80%. Although confirmation will probably take a few weeks, the speed of what we're seeing in this economic decline is rare. In looking at the economic history since the end of the war, there are really only two recessions that have acted this aggressively, this quickly. One was the 1953-54 recession, which was caused by the demobilization after the Korean War. The second was in 1957 and 1958. This was a really short, deep recession that, interestingly enough, coincided with the Asian flu epidemic of that year, which killed 116,000 Americans and estimated 1 to 4 million worldwide. When you read the narratives of that recession, the flu epidemic is never mentioned. It was really more of a question of overly tight monetary policy and then a late tightening of fiscal policy. But I have to think that the epidemic play along. We are facing a three-headed problem, and that is the real significant change here. We not only have the virus, but we're seeing a spike in financial stress and an oil market collapse. Let's start with the virus. This was already causing significant damage to the U.S. and to the global economy by stretching medical systems. Social distancing was hitting the entertainment, recreation, education, and restaurant industries hard. And we are anticipating follow-on damage from the lost sales now to become lost wages and lost future consumption. After a slow start, the Trump administration is moving with great speed to get ahead of the damage. You're seeing all sorts of comments about a fiscal package. I'm estimating we're going to get $1 trillion to $1.2 trillion on top of what's already been spent. On the other hand, don't get too ahead of your skis on this. It is still Congress, and for those of us who remember TARP being voted down and the carnage that occurred after that, you know, don't count on it till it's actually been passed. But eventually it will be, and it looks like it's going to be quite big. What do we know about the virus? Well, the Chinese experience shows us that reducing social contact does actually work to reduce the pace of infections. It hurts, but they clearly have put slowed down the pace of infections. And unfortunately, in the absence of herd immunity, we can expect the virus to return this fall. All the research we're looking at suggests that we will probably see the peak in infection somewhere in late May and probably start to see a pretty sizable and steady decline in the pace of new infections. In addition, there is some evidence to suggest that heat and humidity do reduce the spread. And so as summer and spring come upon us, there is a chance that we will see the virus spread decline. Let's move on to the financial crisis. Over the past 2 weeks, we've seen a dramatic rise in financial stress. The Bloomberg Financial Conditions Index has fallen to levels consistent with where we were with Bear Stearns in 2008. Funding stresses were evident before the virus. In fact, in September, repo problems had emerged, and the Fed had only worked to partially resolve them. They have moved much more aggressively since, however. We also saw the dollar initially decline, but it has now just absolutely soared, which is another sign of stress. And we've seen increased selling of what have been safety assets, especially gold and long-dated treasuries. This is kind of the classic selling what you can, not what you should problem. We've seen other signals of internal stress, rising LIBOR rates, widening spreads between on-the-run and off-the-run treasuries. These are all indicative of a scramble for cash. Over the past 2 weeks, we would have to say the Fed has also moved with great speed to open up facilities that were last seen during the great financial crisis. We've seen a reopening of the commercial paper facility. Today, the Fed opened the primary dealer facility. They encouraged large banks to use the discount window so smaller banks won't feel as stigmatized by doing so. To some extent, the Fed probably feels like it's playing whack-a-mole right now, that it's waking up every day and a new mole head is picking up and it's gotten to hit it over the head. But for the most part, they've managed to stay in front of it. One of the worries I had when this started was that the Dodd-Frank reduced some of the Federal Reserve's flexibility in what's known as the 13-3 regs, which gives the Fed wide latitude to lend money to entities in the case of a crisis. Some of that flexibility was curtailed under Dodd-Frank, but it doesn't appear to have had much of an effect. The Treasury has been very generous in giving the Fed room to do what's necessary. The one difference we are seeing this time around is the Fed is lending to industries and not individual firms, which got them in a lot of political hot water in 2008. So you can expect lending to all the airlines at some point or all the restaurant firms, but not necessarily to any of the individual firms. And then third, we've seen an oil crisis develop. We already had weaker global demand due to the virus, but then OPEC and Russia were unable to agree on an output reduction. In the absence of an agreement, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia has decided it will not cede market share to China. Everyone is blaming shale for this. This has almost nothing to do with shale. This is all about a market share war between Russia and Saudi Arabia over China. This one is going to be long and drawn out because Russia has significant armor that it can deploy in this war. It can depreciate its currency. It will draw down its sovereign wealth funds. On the other hand, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia has ample foreign reserves that it will draw. So this is not going to end soon or easily. We've seen two other similar events to this, one in the mid-1980s and one in the late 1990s, which, by the way, coincided with the Asian economic crisis. The U.S. has very little leverage to end this. You've heard things out there, well, the administration's going to force these guys to behave differently. Don't count on it. It doesn't mean the U.S. has no leverage. If you remember from the book Daniel Yergin's The Prize, he described Vice President Bush's efforts to end the 1986 event, but there's not a whole lot of evidence that he had all that much to do with it. To some extent, he was pushing on an open door. We have already projected oil in the $20 to $25 range, and this afternoon we actually got really close to that $20 level. The longer this goes on and the more negative the virus affects the global economy, the greater likelihood we get a sub-20 price, despite the fact that the government is going to try to help the oil industry by adding oil to the strategic reserve. You might remember in 2015 and 16, the drop in oil prices lowered earnings for the U.S. And put us on the brink of recession. The oil industry in the U.S. will be hit hard and probably won't get a lot of support from Congress. So let's talk about market effects. Our base case is this is a very deep but very short recession, and we think our 2,300 low for this bear market should hold. Now, we did violate it intraday today, but we did see a recovery off of it. Second quarter is going to be quite bad in terms of the economy. A negative 5% GDP is a reasonable evidence. That is far worse decline than average. But the waning of the virus and aggressive policy stimulation should support a good recovery that will become more evident in the second half of the year. If we're wrong, it's probably going to be due to one of two things. One is that the equity markets decide that this is going to be a deep recession similar to 73, 75, 81, 82, 2007, 2009, and that would drop us to the 1700 level on the S&P. That is not our base case. We don't expect that to happen. But if we're wrong and this thing turns out to be deep and long, that's what you should expect. The other is that policymakers make a really serious error, similar to what we saw in September of 2008. It's important to note that our memories play tricks on us, that in September of 2008, up until September of 2008, there was a fairly strong debate among economists as to whether or not we had actually slipped into recession. That the aggressive moves taken by the Fed to cut interest rates and that the fiscal stimulus that we got from the Bush administration may have staved it off. And if you read the transcripts of the August 2008 Fed meeting, Bernanke was being criticized fairly aggressively by some members of the FOMC for cutting rates too much, and they were pushing him to start raising rates in September. And then, of course, we had the events of allowing Lehman Brothers to fail, which cascaded into all sorts of other mistakes, and that led us to the decline in 08. The important thing to remember, it wasn't 08, it wasn't the 08 we remember until September, and that occurred because of a parade of errors. Here are some of my thoughts on the longer-term aftermath of this event. One of the questions I've been getting from advisors is, gosh, you know, the government's going to spend $1 trillion, maybe $1.5 trillion. We got rates at zero already. Isn't this going to trigger inflation? Well, there's going to be plenty of liquidity jammed into the market, but what I anticipate we're going to see is something similar that we saw in the aftermath of the great financial crisis, which is that velocity is going to fall. That you've got a generation of Americans now that have lived through three major bear markets and are now looking up and saying, you know what, I don't trust anything. I need to have a lot of cash on hand. And so I think they're going to take that cash and further shore up their balance sheets and spend it a lot less aggressively than what we would have expected in the past. Secondly, we have been calling for a retreat from globalization for some time. It's becoming apparent that the COVID-19 is going to act as an accelerant. Relations between the U.S. And China are becoming profoundly strained. And one of the things that has shocked me to some extent is watching the European Union fray before our very eyes. Countries within the EU are putting up border impediments. The free movement that we've seen in the EU since the early 90s looks like that's going away. The Germans don't want to share goods with the Italians. This is a deglobalized world, is a world that's going to be less friendly to capital. So that's a good background for what I see going on here. The key takeaway that you should have from this is that although we're all talking about the virus is only one leg of this stool. The other two legs are very important, too. The financial stress and the problems with oil are also very critical. And frankly, any one of them on their own may have triggered a recession, but they may not have. But as a group, it raises the level of the odds of inflation of a recession to a near certain level. With that, Mark, I'm going to shock the world and wind up my comments and turn it back to you.
Very good. Thanks, Bill. I'm going to make some comments about our equity portfolios first, our balanced accounts, and our asset allocation strategies. All under the heading or the question, what is Confluence doing to manage these portfolios and the world we're in right now. Well, Bill started with a no duh statement, so I'll make another one. We are in a cyclical bear market. It came upon us very suddenly, about as suddenly as I've ever seen. What is a cyclical bear? Well, it's a severe market downturn that precedes and accompanies a recession. I don't put percentages on that like the folks on TV do, but you kind of know it when you see it, and we're definitely in one. From an investment perspective, there's two things we must keep our eyes on now that we're in the cyclical bear. In fact, we keep our eyes on this ahead of time, but it's even more important when you're in it. Those two things are, number one, the character of the recession, and number two, the likely character of the recovery. And there is going to be a recovery. It's always hard to imagine when you're in it like this, but it's extremely important to have your eyes on the recovery as well. A stock portfolio is a collection of ownership stakes in businesses. And while, you know, we're seeing numbers change on the screen, go from green to red, back to green and red, and all, it's easy to think that, you know, this is a game like numbers on a roulette wheel. But we own our stakes in businesses, and those businesses have different characteristics. That leads us to two important actions that our analysts and portfolio managers are undertaking today. Number one, make sure our companies survive the recession. This is really the most important thing any active manager can do in a recession. A passive portfolio owns everything, and we don't have to. There's an old adage you probably heard me say before, if you would finish first, you must first finish. And we're always focused on this, even when we're not in a recession. But once you get into a recession, you have to take a look at the character of it. Sometimes the character of a recession is evident months or even years in advance, but this one didn't give us that opportunity. As Bill just pointed out, or if you saw my client letter on Monday, I pointed out, while the debt structure of American businesses was well known and something that we were watching, the coronavirus and the oil price war came upon us rather suddenly. Coronavirus just gave us a few weeks' notice. The price war and energy, hit us, 2 weeks into this sell-off. As a result, as the nature of the risks change, the nature of a company's staying power or survivability may change. So, you may have seen us sell stocks. You may see us sell stocks in the future and replace them with positions that are different, new stocks. Some of these stocks we may have held a long time, some of them just bought recently. The reason is that the changing nature of the risks, and you have noticed this has been a very fluid situation as to risks. And what we're doing is adjusting to the changing nature of these risks and making decisions where we believe we can upgrade the staying power of the portfolio. And that really gets us to the second point that our analysts and PMs are focused on right now, and it's that word upgrade. They probably get tired of hearing me say this whenever we're in a bear market. And if you've talked to me recently, you've probably heard me say, bear markets are the best times to upgrade a portfolio. They're not all the same. Not all the stocks are the same. I always, one of my other hackneyed phrases is, your stocks in your portfolio aren't like your kids. You don't love them all the same. You have stronger and weaker positions, even in a high-grade portfolio. We like to think ours is a high-grade portfolio. But there are some positions, particularly when the world changes rapidly as it has, where you have opportunities to upgrade. And that's really the nature of the business we're talking about here, not the nature of the stock. We're looking for businesses that we believe can recover quickly, not because they're highly leveraged and they just barely avoided bankruptcy and bounced back fast. That's a speculative way to play recoveries. No, we prefer a less leveraged, more liquid company whose business recovers quickly. One of my favorite quotes is that of John Stowers of Kansas City, founder of the 20th Century Funds, and a growth investor, by the way. He said, in a falling market, you want to own tennis balls, not tomatoes. And it's so true, and our team is focused on this. These are the businesses that people will want to own when they come out of their bunkers, and there's a lot of people that are obviously in bunkers these days. We've been getting, you know, people have sent in some questions. We've got a few on the subject of downside capture, so I wanted to address it in my prepared remarks. In the midst of a rapid sell-off like this one, we often get asked, where's that good downside capture that Confluence is known for? Well, I think there's a misunderstanding of what downside capture really is. It's not some mathematical formula whereby our portfolios day-to-day only drop, oh, let's say 3% when the market drops 5%, or drop 6% when the market drops 10%. I can assure you, I've sat in front of the screen watching our portfolios during these cyclical bear markets, and that's rarely happened. It's especially true in the more modern world we're in, where that's been dominated by passive investors using index funds. And when they push the sell button, everything in the index gets sold, even the stuff that we own. This results in great waves of sell orders day to day, which is what we've seen over the last 3+ weeks. And by the way, which we saw in exactly the same way in the fourth quarter of 2008. So what should you know about downside capture, other than we don't have a magic formula? Well, number one, when you look at statistics on downside capture, whether they're reported by us or by those who monitor us on the outside, it's calculated on a quarterly basis, not on a day-to-day or week-to-week basis. And that's entirely appropriate because we're long-term investors, as we hope you and your clients are if you're with us. Day-to-day is not ever going to give you a good reading. So it's calculated quarter to quarter, and I also like to look at it, year to year when I evaluate us historically or any other manager. Our good downside capture over the years, historically, in my opinion, is due to three characteristics of our investment philosophy and practice. Number one, we tend not to overpay for the stocks we own. Now, obviously, when earnings disappear, it looks like you've overpaid, but we're talking about the general valuation analysis we do. On a normalized basis, we tend not to get overexcited and overpay. Number two, and this sounds familiar, our companies tend to recover more quickly from recession, and so do their stocks. It's the old tennis balls versus tomatoes idea. And number three, our companies tend to survive recessions. This was particularly true in the 2008-2009 recession, when there were a lot of large cap banks and financial stocks in particular that went bankrupt. It wasn't that we were not in the financial sector, we were, with roughly a market weighting, but we avoided those companies that didn't survive. That's extremely important. That doesn't show up, by the way, in day-to-day market prices when the whole market's getting slammed. Back then, in 2008 and 2009, our stocks were getting slammed day to day too, but they bounced back through the course of the bear market. And that's really the key of how long-term investors can survive and thrive. And that's our objective today. Let's talk a bit about balanced accounts. Really, the only way to dampen volatility on the downside is through a balanced account, which means this account that has both stocks and bonds in it. Now, you can do this in the same account, or you can have them in different parts of your portfolio. At some of the firms we work with, we're able to offer balanced accounts. And this, but we got to remember, this dampens volatility in both down and in up markets. Again, there's no magic formula for limiting the downside, but providing all the upside in a long-term portfolio. For those of you in balanced accounts at Confluence, you'll note that we rebalanced most of them today. 99% of the time, normal buying and selling, deposits and withdrawals in these accounts keep them within the guardrails of that balance between stocks and bonds, because we continuously monitor that balance. But when you get massive moves like we've had over the last 3 weeks, big upward moves in high-grade bonds, downward moves in stocks, most of our balanced accounts moved beyond the guardrails last week. We chose today to bring them back to their appropriate percentages. We sold bonds in the morning. We bought stocks in the afternoon. This is not trying to time the market. I think that's something some people sometimes misunderstand about balanced accounts. We're not trying to time the market. We are just prudently rebalancing when the numbers say we should. And then finally, asset allocation strategies, which are available at some of the firms we work at. We have an asset allocation team that invests in exchange-traded funds. It takes a more of a medium-term view of investing using a 3-year forward time frame. In an era when changes in market prices occur quickly and severely as economic outlooks change, asset allocation, whether you're using one of our asset allocation accounts or you're asset allocating across all your portfolios and your strategies, it's really an investor's best tool to protect oneself. We had become increasingly concerned about the economy, not that we thought coronavirus was coming. We didn't have we weren't right on top of our crystal ball is fuzzy like everyone else's. We think, as I said in my client letter on Monday, you know, listen, I've been saying for years we can't predict the future. We work on odds, but we were becoming more and more concerned, particularly about the debt structure in the world and the devolving of globalization. And so, in recent quarters, and particularly in January, we increased the relative duration and investment quality of our fixed income allocations, and we increased our allocations to gold in those strategies for which commodity allocations were appropriate. These allocations have cushioned some, but not all, of the downside in the equity allocations. Our asset allocation team normally makes changes in the middle of the first month in the quarter, but they can act at different times in the quarter if they prefer. And they are on the case. They are watching events very closely there. Well, I'll just wrap up by saying we at Confluence have seen a lot of financial crises over the last 40-plus years. Each one is different, and this one is extraordinary in its uniqueness. Yet there are similarities to each, namely that one of them is that we come out of each one, as hard as that is to believe when you're in it. Each one also presents extraordinary opportunities, and we likewise are doing our best both to survive and to thrive as we come out on the other side. Hope that these comments from both Bill and I have been helpful, but I'm sure that there are questions that you have. So I'm going to turn it over to the operator to begin asking some questions. And we've got a few questions that were sent in. And a few questions. Well, here's one that was sent in just recently. And that is regarding the Chinese stock market. It was down, has been down peak to trough less than the U.S. Market. And the question is why the difference. I think one thing you need to know, I'll make a few comments on that, and Bill may have some comments. Number one is the Chinese stock market is not nearly as well developed as the U.S. stock market. It is a relatively undeveloped market, and with not near the participation worldwide and the liquidity. In fact, a lot of folks who there's a lot of restrictions on who can invest in the Chinese stock market. As a result of that, it didn't move up as much as our market did. It's a good way to describe it. It's a little bit like a micro cap stock relative to the big cap stocks in the markets. Its behavior is often very different, and we shouldn't be surprised if it's very different. I don't spend a lot of time trying to so much explain what's going on. I kind of like try to figure out what is going on. And, you know, frankly, the stock market in the U.S. is really the world stock market. It kind of leads the show. And the Chinese market is, again, kind of like a small cap stock that can kind of does its own thing. Bill, you have some comments on that you'd like to?
Some of this is probably related to how this virus unfolded. The Chinese market initially got hit really hard. But when the expectation was, or when the belief was, hey, this is going to be a short-term thing, it's probably just going to be contained in China, it's probably not going to last that long, we actually saw their market recover pretty quickly. And then the sentiment changed. You know, Europe started reporting cases, and then the U.S. reported a lot of cases. And suddenly it was like our turn in the barrel. To some extent, the financial markets kind of gave the Chinese a bit of a pass because conditions were just different then. The second factor about this is that the Chinese financial system, although it is, there's all sorts of evidence that it is over leveraged, it is also controlled. And you know, our position on China is that China is facing a bad debt problem, very similar to what Japan had in the late 80s, and our expectation is their solution's probably going to look pretty similar. The other element of this is China is a net beneficiary from low oil prices. They're kind of where we were in the late 90s. Low oil prices was kind of an unalloyed good. It's not true for the United States anymore. We're the biggest producer of oil in the world, and thus low oil prices are going to actually have a negative effect on significant elements of our economy. In that regard, China's getting a kind of a benefit here because, you know, oil around $20 a barrel, WTI, is a significant support for their economy and thus their markets.
Thank you, Bill. And using my small cap stock or micro cap stock illustration, yeah, you're right. It's a controlled market. So imagine a small cap stock where insiders control 80% of the float. It's hard to describe the other 20% that trades publicly as kind of a fair representation of what's going on. It's just a very different market, and the oil situation is also much different. Before we go to questions from the operator, I might just repeat something that Wayne said at the beginning. Because of the nature, you know, public nature of this call, we cannot comment on individual stocks or positions we hold on this call. We're not trying to avoid them. You can contact your Confluence representative on this. You can send emails in. We take questions and phone calls all the time. But on a call like this, it just works much better for this for the situation, as well as for our ability to offer a replay that we cannot discuss any individual names on the call. Okay, operator, can we go to the first question, please?
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. Again, that is star, then the number one to ask a question. We'll pause for just a moment. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad.
While we're waiting for a question, we had another one wired in. How, if at all, are you positioning the portfolio today versus the way you were thinking pre-coronavirus? Not too much differently. There's just a handful of positions that have a very direct hit to as a result of the coronavirus. You know, it clearly, this is one of those events, you know, pandemics of this nature are rare it's really, I think you kind of have to go back to one that's really worldwide. I think you have to go back to the 1957 flu epidemic. I believe that was the H1N1 flu epidemic, pandemic. So they're not something. They're not something like other macroeconomic events that you can predict easily. But again, a well-diversified portfolio should, you know, should have to make a lot of changes. And honestly, you know, there's a handful of stocks that we have owned across all our portfolios that were in the crosshairs. Some were sold, some were not. More to the point, though, opportunities have been have grown as a result. And some, when I talked before about upgrading portfolios, there's some truly outstanding businesses out there which we have found by our yardsticks, just that used to be far too expensive for us, that are coming into our trading ranges that we find very attractive. So probably the biggest change in the way we're thinking post-coronavirus is in terms of some of the opportunities that have presented themselves. Operator, do we have any questions?
We have a question.
On the phone. Go ahead.
We have a question from Grant Ingram with Benjamin F. Edwards.
Guys, the swiftness of this sell-off, is it signaling something much worse than 08? I know it's hard to tell right now, but I've heard other economists say that it's pricing in a 50 to 80% hit in corporate earnings. Is there anything else that we should know about the swiftness and the severity of the sell-off?
Mark, you want to swing at that first?
Yep.
Okay.
I'll give it a shot. Well, clearly, there is going to be a sharp decline in corporate earnings, particularly from, you know, middle of March through probably most of the second quarter. It is, you know, I've always thought that just taking earnings and multiplying them times a multiple is a pretty overly simplistic way to view stocks, but it's the way that most people do. A company, let's just posit a company with no debt and a big pile of cash. If their earnings go from $1 to zero, their valuation doesn't go from $10 to zero. There is a appropriate valuation, particularly since the value of a company is really the present value of their long-term earnings, you know, discounted. And so if you look at the long-term earnings of any company, 2020's earnings are going to be a mess, particularly in the first half. But that doesn't mean that the long-term, the value, the present value of those earnings for the next 10 years are also damaged. So, but I know how people are, and this one, this the emotions tied it with this are extraordinary. And it's really, and we are human beings and we have emotions, and it is very difficult to separate our worry about ourselves and our families from, as a result of this virus, from what's going on. And I think that's a significant part of it as well. I don't, you know, it is possible, as Bill told before, that, you know, this goes a lot, you know, that we go down, you know, on the magnitude of 2008, 2009, and that may be what the market is signaling, but honestly, nobody knows that. We just have to deal with the prices that are being offered to us today. Bill, what do you think?
I think there's an element of this decline that is reflecting what happened in the great financial crisis, which is that there is an underlying concern, I think, among market participants that when you increase the chances for policymakers to make a mistake, that they will. And you know what? That's not really unreasonable. After we saw, you know, you can make a really good case that in September it was like watching a drunk through a minefield. They just kept stepping on landmines and blowing stuff up. And so I think there's a little bit of, or maybe a lot of, a lack of confidence that policymakers won't make similar mistakes. I don't think that's probably all that likely. You know, the lessons learned by the Fed, by the Treasury, after going through 08, are still pretty fresh. And if you look at how the Fed is acting here, gosh, you know, I've been pretty impressed. You know, they've moved very fast. They've been reopening these facilities. I was really, as I said in my prepared comments, I was really concerned that they were going to get resistance from the White House about, you know, opening up these credit facilities. But so far, Mnuchin and Powell, who are good friends, have been working very well together on this, and it's the old thing about you wish what you wish for. I would wish that we would have a more robust financial system than we do. I have lots of ideas on how to fix that. Thus far, none of the policymakers have ventured out to Webster Groves, Missouri, to ask, nor do I expect that they will. But at least if you're going to have a fragile financial system, it makes a lot of sense to be willing to come in and provide liquidity for it when things get bad, and that's exactly what they're doing. So the speed of this decline looks a lot like when things started going bad in 08, and I suspect that's a lot of muscle memory, but it's probably not going to end up being appropriate. I don't think they're going to blow this thing like they did then.
Operator, do we have another question? Thanks, Grant, by the way.
There are no additional questions at this time.
Very good. Well, we thank you for joining us. We stand ready here to, as you know, to be accessible to you every day. And, you know, both Bill and I and the members of our portfolio management team, as well as our representatives out there led by Wayne Knowles. Wayne, would you like to wrap up the call today?
Yes,
excuse
thank
me,
you,
sir. I'm sorry. We did have one additional question that just came in. It's from William Perry with Baird.
Very good. Thank you.
Yeah, I know you guys are baseball fans, so just tell me when the season's going to start.
Thank you. Thank you, William. Bill, yeah, we are. You got any thoughts on that, Bill?
Gosh, not soon enough. We watch a lot of sports in my household, and the lack of hockey and NCAA basketball and baseball, I mean, we're watching reruns of Perry Mason just to kind of keep sharp. Just looking at how some of the expectations of how this is behaving, I'm kind of hopeful that by mid-May we've got a shot at seeing Major League Baseball come back. My oldest son works in minor league baseball, and I have to say so far it's been kind of radio silence. So they still don't know, but I'm kind of hoping mid-May we start to see the ice break.
Well, I hope so, too, and that was going to be my thought. I think we'll be sometime early May, I would expect, we'll be hearing from them. Meanwhile, I'm watching when I can the MLB Network. They had a special on Tony Gwynn on Saturday night. If you saw that, it was wonderful. So, yeah, we're trying to get our baseball fix any way we can.
Wonderful. As we close this out, let me thank everyone for being a part of the call. And also to mention, I know a number of you waited. We had such a flood of callers. Thank you for your patience. And as Mark said, we stand ready to help. Please reach out to us as we can. Thank you very much.
Thank you. This concludes today's conference. You may now disconnect.